We all know the world of energy and natural resources is changing fast. People are demanding action on the climate crisis. Businesses and politicians are throwing their weight behind the energy transition. And technology is reshaping the world as we know it. But we must ensure the result doesn't become too complex and too confusing. That's where the Climate Transition Podcast comes in. In this series, DLA Piper's Energy and Natural Resources team speaks to special guests to help you make sense of it all. My name is Natasha Luther-Jones. I'm the Global Co-Chair of the Energy and Natural Resources sector here at DLA Piper. I'm also co-head of our International Sustainability and ESG offering. And I am your host for the series. Today we ask, is floating offshore wind about to go supersized? Offshore wind is growing fast. There's now more than 64 gigawatts of offshore wind farms in operation globally. That's eight times more than the figure a decade ago. And that is set to grow sixfold to 380 gigawatts by 2032, according to the Global Wind Energy Council. At present, the industry is almost wholly reliant on fixed bottom offshore wind. I'm sure you all know this, but that means wind farms where the turbines are connected to the seabed. But in the future, that could change completely with the emergence of floating wind technology. This could really help open up vast numbers of sites that are currently inaccessible. In future, fixed bottom offshore wind is predicted to account for only 20% of global offshore wind potential. The other 80% is in deeper waters. What will it take to unlock the sites? How big can floating wind get? And will it be key to the energy transition? To help make sense of this all, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Andy Lewin, Head of Engineering at offshore wind developer Corio Generation. Andy has worked in the offshore wind sector since 2010 and now heads up engineering at Corio, which has over 30 gigawatts of fixed and floating offshore wind projects in development. Andy, welcome.
Thanks, Natasha. Great to be with you today.
So let's get started. So to begin with, Andy, let's let the listeners hear a little bit more about you. So how did you get into offshore wind?
Sure, no problem at all. So I'm really lucky to have spent pretty much my whole professional career working in renewables. I started out just shortly after graduating, working on onshore wind and was involved in the boom of the mid-noughties, building onshore wind farms in the UK and Ireland. And then in around about 2008, when offshore wind was starting to take off, my employer started to explore that opportunity, and I was fortunate enough to be offered the opportunity to transition in 2010 into our offshore wind team. Worked on a number of the early round two and round three projects, and have never really looked back. You know, as an engineer, there's so many fascinating problems to try and solve in offshore wind, and I've been really fortunate to have a number of different roles affording me a number of different perspectives on our industry over the years.
Sounds great. And we all remember the boom of the rock wind projects. From a lawyer's perspective, when we used to look at it, in the beginning we were struggling with rocks, and now I look at it, God, wasn't that the easy days? But anyway, so what does your role at Corio Generation involve then?
So I'm fortunate to lead a team of 50 really talented engineering professionals at Corio Generation. We have a number of engineering teams based around the world working on our fantastic portfolio of projects throughout the project life cycle, focusing on new markets, developing markets, and very mature markets as well.
And then clearly, because the topic of this conversation is floating, the obvious question I would ask next is floating wind an important part of your future plans then?
I think floating wind is an important part of the future for offshore wind globally. it will facilitate the expansion of offshore wind into new markets and new regions, as you said in your introduction. And at Corio Generation, we're committed to realising the potential of floating wind, and we believe that technology affords us the opportunity to enter new markets and is going to play a significant role in enabling the energy transition in a number of emerging markets. For us, the floating wind technology is still in the nascent stage, and therefore it's really important that we choose the right markets in which to explore that technology. Those markets for us have to have a really strong policy commitment to renewables, excellent wind resource, and good industrial capabilities to ensure that the projects are ultimately deliverable.
That's really interesting, looking at why it's important to you. Just a little bit more about then, why is it crucial? You said it's going to play a significant role in the energy transition. Why do we need it?
I think you said in your introduction, 80% of the developable sea area around the world, so reasonably proximate to the coastline, is in water depths beyond the reach of conventional fixed technology. So if we're going to realise the potential of offshore wind to really underpin the energy transition to net zero, we need to develop the technologies that enable us to access that resource and provide that low-cost green energy that offshore wind has proven so adept at delivering.
Yes, so a little bit more work to do on developing the technology then, because some of the other figures we looked at was that the headline capacity for launching floating wind projects I saw was 100 megawatts recently. But how do we then go from 100 megawatts to make that jump to 1 gigawatt plus? Is it going to be easy to do? Is it going to be too hard? Is it a long way off?
I think, look, there's absolutely no doubt it's a massive industrial challenge. Floating wind to date has predominantly been at the prototypical stage, and we're now transitioning into commercial scale projects. We've gone from one-off prototypes to, small arrays of 5 or 6 turbines, and the next logical step is to move into the 100 plus megawatt multiples of hundreds and ultimately gigawatts. And the challenge for the industry is really turning that science project into a sustainable commercial proposition. Moving from one-off production to serial manufacture and developing the repeatable, scalable methods and technological solutions. Yeah, it's a significant undertaking and will require enormous investment in the engineering capability, the facilities and the infrastructure to deliver the solutions required.
So I think the listeners are going to be really interested to find out more about how we get the investment in, what the investment's needed, and more about what the technical challenges are. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about these challenges? Because a lot of us are familiar with offshore wind, but I think it would be good to hear more about the challenges for floating.
Absolutely, no problem. So, for me, floating wind is a hugely exciting area to be working in as an engineer. There's no doubt in my mind that this is almost a once-in-a-generation technological challenge. I don't think you can underestimate the scale of these structures when you consider what we're talking about moving is, a structure that's probably in excess of 300 metres tall, weighs tens of thousands of tonnes, could be almost as much as 100 metres across. So the facilities required and the technological endeavour necessary to construct and transport these items is really significant.
It's massive. Gosh.
It absolutely is. And we're at a stage with floating wind where we're adopting some quite mature turbine technologies that have been developed in FIX. So we're not starting small, we're starting massive. And that introduces its own challenges. The solutions that we have from fixed wind for assembling and installing floating wind turbines just simply won't work. So we have to develop our own solutions. We have to adopt transferable technologies from the likes of oil and gas, you know, the logistical solutions that we need to develop to be able to move these structures around are really massively significant. The systems engineering challenge of integrating all of the different parts within a floating wind structure is really an enormous undertaking. And to be able to develop the facilities such that we can build, assemble, integrate a sufficient number of these devices quickly enough to make the duration of our projects manageable, to make them investable, is really no small undertaking whatsoever. You know, there are key technological areas that we have to resolve to be able to transition into industrial scale floating wind. Dynamic cables is a great example of an area where there's a huge amount of development happening right now, and an area where we're taking a technology that we've established in the fixed wind space of high voltage cables and transforming the application from a steady state fixed solution into a highly dynamic environment where, you know, over the life of a wind farm, those cables will see millions of cycles of motion, and understanding the impact on the electrical and structural performance of those cables is a big undertaking. Equally, we're now moving from undertaking construction, commissioning, operational activities on fixed static platforms to doing all of that on dynamic platforms that are constantly in motion. And that presents a whole load of new challenges, both in terms of, yeah, personnel access, moving people about, but also the performance of those people when they're on those structures. So everywhere we look, there's new challenges around the human-machine interface, around, yeah, the machine-to-machine interface, lots of really fascinating challenges and problems to solve.
Gosh, I have to say, from listening to that, not being an engineer, it sounds hugely challenging, but also very exciting as well. Now, from a lawyer's perspective, when I hear all this, I immediately start thinking, oh, risk, money. How can you unlock the investment then that's going to be needed for what is clearly a really, really exciting area, and we have to find solutions for it, for the energy transition, but how will we unlock the investment that's needed?
For me, in the floating wind space, what's crucial is project certainty. So, you know, a stable policy environment, yeah, predictable long-term outcomes for projects is hugely important. So markets where there's strong policy support and strong pipeline visibility. So being able to understand not just what the project you're working on has a route to market and a long-term prospect, but also that there's opportunity for future investment that can underwrite some of the infrastructure and non-project specific investments that are going to be required to drive these projects forward. You know, the role of government is really significant in ensuring that they provide the right types of industrial support, both to the projects, but also to the enabling infrastructure developments. Yeah, that investment in ports, manufacturing facilities, but also, you know, people, skills, is an enormous part of getting us to the right industrial solution for floating wind, and must all be part of a joined up industrial strategy.
Yeah, and maybe we could come back to that point a little bit later. What markets do have that government support and stability? Because it's absolutely clear you need that to be able to get the investment in. Just before we sort of move off what it's all about, can I just ask a question around supply chain? Because we hear supply chain issues across all different sorts of renewable energy assets. I'd be interested to know, is floating less or more affected by supply chain issues?
So I think, yeah, for me, floating wind, as I say, is in a transitional phase. So we're moving from the science project to the pre-commercial to the industrial scale. And there's always a more or a higher level of risk and uncertainty associated with projects that are going through that transition rather than projects such that we have elsewhere in fixed wind, onshore wind and renewables that are repeating what has been done before. So inevitably, floating wind is probably additionally exposed to some of the uncertainties that exist within the supply chain. Yeah, for me, you know, the the facilities that we require for floating wind presents one of the key constraints. I was looking at some analysis the other day done by one of my colleagues that showed me that we require approximately five times the amount of land space or real estate to be able to assemble a floating wind structure as we do for a fixed wind structure, because as I mentioned previously, the width, the footprint of these floating foundations is so significant. So if you then multiply that up and think for the same gigawatt scale project that you're developing as a fixed wind farm to develop as a floating wind farm, you need five times the amount of real estate. And trust me when I say the facilities that they use to build fixed wind are far from small. So we're really looking at some enormous facilities and some very clever manufacturing solutions to be able to develop and deliver a sufficient number of floating foundations quickly enough. And then once we've built them, how do we assemble them, and how do we find the supply chain to provide all of the enabling technologies, whether that's mooring and anchoring, which has been predominantly serving a marine supply chain and an oil and gas supply chain. And the demand from floating wind alone could be many multiples of the existing demand in the market. And I spoke earlier about dynamic cables and the technological challenge that faces, that presents to us. But we also see supply chain challenges in terms of delivering sufficient facilities with the machinery and capability to be able to deliver those size and scales of cables that we require.
So a few more challenges to overcome then, Andy. Before we move off challenges then, I don't even want to ask this because you've got so much to overcome already, but I do have to ask this. We've heard a lot over the last few years about the financial pressures on turbine manufacturers. Does that affect the research that needs to take place or the appetite from the turbine manufacturers?
So the answer to that is yes and no. I mentioned previously, this is a very complicated multidimensional engineering problem. And the reality is the engineering complexity, without getting too geeky about it, of designing the interface between the big white spinny thing and the large yellow floaty thing is an order of magnitude more complicated than it was in the fixed space. And therefore, it requires a lot more engineering effort, and that's more engineering hours. And that presents a challenge for the wind turbine manufacturers because they have a finite amount of resource, and there's a fairly vibrant internal competitive market for that resource to support projects across the markets in which they're active. And it's difficult for the floating wind teams to make the argument to arguably utilize a disproportionate amount of that resource to support the relatively small and to some extent uncertain floating wind projects that are, as I say, transitioning into the industrial stage at the moment. So that is a disadvantage for floating wind, but I believe all of the wind turbine manufacturers recognize that floating wind will be part of the offshore wind landscape in the future, and therefore it's necessary for them to invest in that capability, but as we spoke about previously, for developers picking the right markets in which to develop this emerging technology, it's equally important for the wind turbine manufacturers to select the right projects with the right developers to ensure they're developing the right solutions.
Quite a few challenges, but clearly turbine manufacturers then are investing in it. Corio Generation is clearly investing in this area, and we see a lot of press about this generally. So I suppose the question then is, where's the most promising markets? Where are you focusing on, and where do you think the money's going to go?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned previously, there's a lot of focus on where is the right place to develop floating wind for the first time at commercial scale. And for us in Corio, we're really fortunate to have an excellent opportunity in the Korean market alongside our partners Total and SK Ecoplant, and our Grey Whale 3 project is likely to be our first generation floating wind project, and we believe that Corio and Korea is a great match as a as a very agile and capable and experienced developer working in a market where there's really strong policy support and excellent industrial heritage, making a success of floating wind is definitely achievable. Yeah, in addition to Korea, we see big potential in the UK. As an established global leader in offshore wind, but also with a growing longer term potential in floating wind, with ScotWind having been launched a couple of years ago, and the Round 5 Celtic Sea coming in 2024-25. We're also actively exploring opportunities in the Norwegian market, and we see there being great potential there, both in terms of wind resource and their legacy in the energy industries. Beyond that, there are good markets emerging elsewhere in Europe, the US and APAC, and we're exploring all of those to make sure they have the right conditions for us to continue to support.
Just the one country that you didn't mention, if I'm thinking about it, that one of my colleagues has been talking about quite a bit, is they mentioned, my Spanish colleague said, something has changed in Spain. There's some, I think, some legislation's come out, and that there will be no fixed bottom offshore wind there because of the depths, and that they're quite confident that floating wind will take off in Spain. What's your view on Spain then? Is that right?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of encouraging noises coming out of Spain for a number of years now, and that's been great, but there has been an absence of clear policy direction. But that's changed in the last couple of weeks. We've seen a draft royal decree published and a consultation ongoing at the moment, looking at the Spanish market and how they'll look to offer development opportunities into the developer community within the different Spanish regions. It's true to say that there is very little, if any, fixed wind potential within the Spanish coastal regions. Yeah, the seabed drops away very quickly on the Spanish coast, and therefore, in all likelihood, should they choose to exploit their offshore wind resources, it will have to be utilising floating wind technology.
Okay, but it sounds a little bit further off from your discussions on South Korea and the UK. Maybe let's go to South Korea then. I think you mentioned the reason you're focusing there, government support and a strong industrial heritage. Is there any other reasons that you're attracted to South Korea, or you think that's the big market that's going to take off?
So I think there's a number of things. Yeah, crucially for any offshore wind site, you've got to have strong wind resource, good wind resource, and in the right parts of Korea where we're looking at developing these projects, we have a good healthy wind resource, and that's crucial because that's our fuel, and that underpins the economics of our projects, making sure we're getting good availabilities and good what we call capacity factors. Yeah, in addition to that, it's important, as I say, that there's a stable policy landscape, and that requires sort of stable long-term democracies and good kind of capitalist economics. And all of those prerequisites exist within the Korean market. I think the industrial heritage is super important as well. They have a legacy of not only building and successfully delivering large-scale domestic infrastructure projects, they have a track record of exporting that capability all around the world, and there are many companies in the Korean market with a lot of the transferable knowledge and expertise to be able to successfully support the supply chain development necessary for floating wind. And I think finally, and most crucially, they have world-leading shipbuilding and large-scale steel fabrication capability. And given the size and scale of our floating wind foundations, finding industrial partners that have the transferable knowledge and expertise to be able to industrialize the manufacture of these substructures is crucial to resolving the big challenges, as I said previously, of moving from the science project to full-scale industrial deployment.
Well, it sounds like South Korea is doing it right. I wonder, just looking at other sort of governments, so and policymakers and regulators, how can they better support floating wind projects then, so that we can create this dynamic elsewhere?
So I think it's about long-term policy certainty. So it's about creating the policy framework to enable, you know, private investors to feel confident investing, you know, the tens of millions of pounds required to, you know, develop a project to a level of technical, commercial and environmental definition that's necessary to be able to move into full-scale construction and deployment. I think, you know, for me, you look at a market like the UK, for example, where we've very much taken a lead in facilitating some of those pre-commercial scale projects, but we're not necessarily moving at the pace we could be in providing the policy and regulatory framework to support the transition of those projects into the next generation and first generation of an industrial scale. And that's not just about the support that's in place for the developers, as I said previously, that's about also creating the policy landscape and policy support for the enabling infrastructure. And particularly important is the port facilities. And in the UK, we do have some unique challenges given the private ownership of many of our coastal port facilities, and therefore creating, as I say, the long-term market visibility to underwrite the necessary kind of private investment to evolve and develop those facilities, build the quay sides, create the hard standing, the lay down areas, the manufacturing real estate that's going to be necessary to deploy floating wind at scale in the UK.
Yeah, that is, so there's still a lot that the governments could do, and in particular in the UK then. Do you think, though, if we went back to the help that developers potentially need, do you think competitive auctions are the way forward, or are we going to see, you know, we've had issues with profit margins on fixed bottom offshore wind projects. Are auctions the way forward for floating?
I think the CFD is here to stay. I think policy and regulators, policymakers and regulators, I should say, they like the CFD. They like the competitive element, ensuring that they're getting best value for the customer. I think the challenge that presents is one of, as I say, long-term certainty for projects. It introduces quite a significant commercial uncertainty, which can make it difficult to create the kind of project conditions to encourage the sort of investment necessary to progress these projects. I mean, I think it's important to reflect on how we've got to where we have with the fixed wind market. And with fixed wind, we were lucky enough to enjoy the ROCs, as you mentioned previously. Mm-hmm. And then following ROCs, you know, we had FID enabling contracts, which weren't competitively awarded. And by the time we embarked on the first round of CFDs, yeah, we'd already deployed over 6 gigawatts of fixed wind in, you know, first and second generation industrial scale projects in the UK. And it wasn't until auction round two of the CFDs where we saw prices fall below £100 a megawatt hour for fixed wind. And at that stage, you know, we had hit deployment levels well in excess of 6 gigawatts, and we had contracted support in place for well in excess of 10 gigawatts of projects. So a very different landscape for a technology that was arguably at a similar stage of transition. And you contrast that with where we are with floating wind. And I was reading earlier today, you know, there's only 227 megawatts of floating wind deployed around the entire world. And the UK government are running their third round of CFDs, including floating wind. And so far, there's only been one award of a contract for floating wind, and that doesn't appear to have materialised into a successful financial investment decision for that project. AR5, both on fixed and floating, was unsuccessful because insufficient support was offered by the government. Yeah, there is a chink of light in that back in November, December, the auction round six pricing was released, and we saw an administrative strike price for floating wind up at £176 a megawatt hour. But within the last few days, we've seen a budget announcement in terms of the support for that auction, in terms of how much money is actually available in the auction to underwrite those projects. And we think that, yeah, there's potentially enough support in there to support somewhere between 100 and maybe 120, 130 megawatts of floating wind at a reasonable cost of energy. And that might mean that we only get one pre-commercial scale project away in this auction. And for me, there is a question there as to whether that's going to be sufficient to start seeding the industrial development that we need to transition into gigawatt scale in the UK.
Oh, I hate being slightly pessimistic because I'm naturally an enthusiastic person. It doesn't feel like that's enough in the UK, but based on what you've just said, is there strong investor appetite? Because there doesn't seem to be a strong pipeline in the UK, but are people interested in investing in floating?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's very strong interest, there continues to be very strong interest in the competitive lease auction rights that are offered in various different markets. We only need to look, you know, go back, maybe is it two and a half years to the ScotWind process, where we saw an unprecedented level of interest in securing those projects. And you know, the Crown Estate are seeing very strong market appetite, as I understand it, for the Round 5 Celtic Sea process. And equally, we understand there are, you know, many interested bidders within the Norwegian process that we anticipate will restart later this year. So there's definitely strong investor appetite in securing floating wind options for the future. And I think what we need to do now is ensure that we're creating the right policy ecosystem to ensure that those options are progressing and maturing such that these projects will come to fruition within a reasonable timescale and support not just the delivery of government targets, which is obviously important, but more crucially, the transition of our economy and our energy infrastructure towards net zero.
Great. So you've brought it back round, Andy. We're back in the room of positivity. So we think floating wind will absolutely help the world get to net zero then, yeah?
Oh, no doubt. I have every confidence that the first generation industrial scale floating projects will come along towards the end of this generation, towards the end of this decade. And that will be the first of many large scale floating projects, which is hugely exciting for me as an engineer and a long term servant of the energy industry.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. Let's have a look then beyond. So that we think we're going to get there at the end of this decade. What does it look like? What do you think the sector will look like in 2035?
I think if we make the right decisions in the next couple of years in the UK and the other, you know, early adopter markets around the world, we'll see projects being deployed on an annual basis, much in the same way that we see in the fixed wind space, hopefully progressing to the gigawatt scale and larger, so that we can really start to leverage in those economies of scales and those industrialization cost reduction benefits and drive down the cost of floating wind, such that we're providing, as I say, long-term, sustainable, clean and affordable megawatts into the different economies around the world.
That's great to hear. So, Andy, we ask all our guests on the podcast, are you optimistic for the future?
As somebody who's worked in this industry for some 15 years, I'm absolutely certain it is a prerequisite to be an optimist to work in offshore wind. So, yeah, I'm absolutely optimistic about what the future holds for offshore wind around the world.
That's great to hear. I share your optimism too. Okay, so I would just like to say thank you very much, Andy, for joining me today. It has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much, Natasha. It's been great to speak with you.
So it's absolutely clear there remain some significant challenges to overcome, technical, commercial, financial, but the need is there, the optimism there. And I genuinely think I've been convinced by Andy that floating wind will be a key part of the energy transition. That just leaves me to say thank you very much for listening. You can find all of our previous episodes on the DLA Piper website or where you usually listen to your podcasts, Spotify, iTunes perhaps, and we'll be back in touch very soon.
Please subscribe to the series at dlapiper.com/ENR or via your usual podcast platform.